Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
President Bush is telling the American people that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are worth fighting. Today, the president is speaking mainly to military families in Idaho, where he handily won re-election. He'll also meet privately with 25 families of troops killed in the war on terror. Joining us from Nampa, Idaho, is USA Today reporter Richard Benedetto, who's traveling with the president. Richard, tell us, first of all, where is the president speaking, and will he be saying anything different than he said on Monday when he spoke to veterans in Utah?
Well, he's speaking at the Idaho Center, which is in Nampa, Idaho, which is about 20 miles, I think, west of Boise. It's actually a Boise suburb, growing Boise suburb, and he's going to be speaking primarily to National Guard families in his speech. I don't expect him to say anything much different other than the fact that he feels the need to reiterate the policy.
Yeah, and as you said, you're on the road with the president, so we'll strain to hear you with your cell phone, and we appreciate it. We're looking at the papers here. I'm sure you're seeing them there. Editorials in the newspapers are welcoming the president, but the Idaho Statesman asked readers to answer the question, what's the best thing the president can do for Idaho? And we were surprised to see how many readers wrote, resign. What are you hearing from people you talk to?
Well, it depends on where you go. If you go to the rallies, anti-war rallies, you hear nothing but negative about the president. If you just walk around and talk to regular people who are not involved, you hear very positive things about the president. This is still Republican country here. There's no question about it. This is not a place where you're going to see protests everywhere in every state. No president gets 100% of the vote at any time. But in this state, it's a fairly friendly state.
Right. And we read in the Idaho Press Tribune, where you are, Nampa, that nearly half of the Idaho National Guard is deployed in Iraq. So this is really resonating there.
Yes, it is. The National Guard is from this area carrying a pretty heavy load.
Yeah. Well, are you hearing people talk, by the way, about Cindy Sheehan? She, of course, the anti-war mother of a soldier killed in Iraq, who a year ago had a private meeting with the president, much the same meeting that many parents will be having this afternoon with the president. She's demanding a second meeting. Are people responding to her?
Oh, of course. There's no question that Cindy Sheehan has struck a chord out there with people who are uneasy about the war and with people who are actually supporters of the war. There's no one who doesn't sympathize with a woman whose son is killed in the war. And it's been a great media magnet, naturally. Yeah. And that's why Bush is here and doing this, because he feels as though he needs to counter her message with his message. And so he's done it twice this week. He's meeting with the military families, and that shows that he's trying to show that I'm maybe refusing to meet with her specifically, but I am meeting with families of just soldiers killed.
These are families of soldiers based at the Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho. What can you tell us about those meetings?
Well, they're always the president does this quite regularly. It's not the first time, and it's not rare. Whenever he visits a military base, which is quite often, he meets with families of the military dead, and from that particular area where he is, and he does it privately. He never gives the names out of the people who he meets with. If the people who come out of those meetings want to talk to the press, that's up to them. But the president does not allow any photographers in there, and he does not come out and talk about the people.
And we understand they can be very emotional meetings.
Obviously they are. Yeah. I would think they are. And today he's got his wife with him, Laura Bush, who will also attend those meetings. He doesn't always have his wife with him when he does it, but she has gone into those meetings in the past with him.
Yeah, and we should note that the Idaho stands to lose 659 jobs at that Mountain Home Air Force Base. A vote is expected later this week from the commission looking at base closures. They're announcing their findings today as well. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yes, there have been stories in the paper about that, too.
Yeah, and I'm sure he'll hear from that as well. Well, one last thought from you. Today's Wall Street Journal Online has a poll that, like most other recent polls, shows the president's approval ratings at its lowest in his presidency, 40%, down a few points from June. It also shows the war in Iraq now tops the list of most important issues, bumping the economy. You know, here, gas is selling for $2.47 a gallon in Idaho. Obviously, there are other concerns in Idaho. But what do these numbers mean for the president in the few seconds we have?
Everything is war right now. The war is everything for him. He has to keep convincing the American people that it's worth it. If he can't, his support dwindles. And while he's not running for re-election, his party has to worry about the 2006 elections, and he has to worry about his own strength in Congress when he goes back. If his Republican support there starts to ease away from him,
and we might see more of these road trips on his vacation.
Yes.
Yeah. USA Today correspondent Richard Benedetto traveling with the president in Idaho today. Richard, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Well, as the Iraq war continues and the number of soldiers suffering from post-traumatic stress increases, the military is looking for answers. Some argue that more money for treatment is needed, but one Army major says that in addition, more time needs to be spent talking about killing. Major Pete Kilner says all soldiers are trained to kill, but they are not trained to talk about it or to think about it in personal terms, and that the military needs to explain to soldiers why killing in combat is morally justified. We're going to have an extended conversation with Major Kilner about killing in combat. And by the way, we welcome your thoughts by email as we go along. You can send questions or comments to letters@here-now.org. But Major Pete Kilner has served in the infantry. He's taught ethics at West Point. He's now writing a PhD on the moral justification for killing, and he runs a blog called The Soldier Ethicist. He joins us from his office in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. With all that you're doing, Major Kilner, we thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And it's provoked a lot of thought, just the topic alone. Tell us, how did you get interested in this?
Well, it's always hard to say where an idea starts and all the influences that come into it. 11 years ago, 1994, I was an infantry captain in the 82nd Airborne Division, and we were preparing to actually invade Haiti in September of 1994 because there had been a coup there. And right before getting on the aircraft, one of the soldiers asked the chaplain, I remember, you know, because we had just been briefed, we'd probably kill about 200 Haitians there in the airfield, who would be defending the airfield. And the soldier asked, you know, is this right? And he seemed really concerned. And the chaplain said, well, you're a soldier. The president says it's right. That makes it right. And at the time, I had more important things, you know, in my mind. But it sort of stuck in my head that there's got to be a better explanation than that.
Yeah.
And then I got lucky because 2 years later, the Army sent me to study philosophy so I could teach it at West Point. And I thought, wow, this is the great opportunity to answer that question.
I also wanted just to say that also up there already in your head, as many of us have in our head, you had two uncles who had served, I read, and nobody ever talked about it, which is the experience most of us had with parents or grandparents who served.
Yes, and I've heard that a lot. I knew there was an uncle who had been a hero in World War II and Korea, and a great person. The only rule was don't talk about war, because sometimes kids will go and ask the questions that they haven't learned what questions not to ask, in a sense. So, yeah, I grew up with that. Even when I joined the Army in 1984, I remember my grandmother saying, you know, if you're going to be a soldier, don't get married until after you've been in combat because you'll come back a changed person. I didn't really follow that rule. I got married anyway. But that was probably all in the back of my head. So when I got to graduate school, I thought, this is the chance to answer this question. And at first, I looked into the just war, or the people who justify war, that literature, and I was really dissatisfied. It's very much at the national level, the geopolitical level. We have to fight because there's a just cause. But it didn't really speak to the personal level of why is it okay for me to kill this other human being.
Well, I know that you, as you started your research, as you said, studying philosophy, You then took out what may be the strangest personal ad I've read in a while in a military journal, because you wanted, as you said, to answer these questions. The ad read, "If you have killed in combat and you feel justified, please send me your comments. I'd like to talk to you." Can you give us, we want to hear more of the personal anecdotes and what you heard as we go along, but what was the overriding thing that you started thinking about killing in combat?
I guess I can answer the question about that ad. Got a lot of responses. Some of the more old retired military along the lines of, you shouldn't be worrying about that. Don't worry about that. Huh. The president worries about that. But overwhelmingly, from the Vietnam generation and from younger, people saying, I'd love to talk about it. I can't really talk about anyone about this.
Nobody talks about it.
And so it was great. And so it was very encouraging that I saw that it was something that people were struggling with. And that it would be worthwhile for me to try to help either find an answer or to at least create a discussion so people can get control of the issue in their own minds.
We want to be clear. You don't have an adversarial relationship with the military. You've said you think yours is a morally justifiable profession. But you say that soldiers need to understand why killing is morally justified. What's your definition of morally justified killing?
Well, I mean, anything morally justified is something that that will be open to a lot of interpretation. It's something that, I guess, is morally right. Killing, there's a whole bunch of criteria that are probably more complicated, because it's a complicated issue.
It is.
I'll say this, because, you know, killing in self-defense is sort of easy, right? If someone intentionally threatens you and they could do great harm to you and you can't avoid the situation, then you're justified in using lethal force. You know, our courts recognize that, and I think people recognize that in their hearts. When you're in war, you're both an individual and a collective agent. So you don't have a personal beef against the soldier there. But, you know, in almost every uniform, a soldier's uniform, it has your name on one side, and it says U.S. Army or Russian Army or whatever the case is on their other side. And you're acting both as an individual and as part of a larger whole. And so that makes the argument from self-defense more complex. I don't think it makes it any less justifiable. But some conditions, like soldiers don't have to avoid the problem if they can because, well, that's where diplomacy failed, right? So they're acting on behalf of all the people. They're acting as a collective agent and an individual agent. So it's complicated, and that's why it's not morally intuitive, and that's why when these heroes go out and kill so that we can be free back here, we really owe it to them to help them think that through. Because I'm convinced that the great majority, 90% of the killing that is going on in Iraq that we're doing is morally justified, but the soldiers don't all understand that, so we need to help them understand that.
Well, I'll tell you what, we want to talk much more about this. We're talking with Major Pete Kilner. He's taught ethics at West Point. He's writing a PhD on the moral justification for killing, and he says that there needs to be much more talk about this. We have about a minute till we'll take a break, and I just want to ask you, it was stunning to us because, in my simple mind, I thought, well, surely there's going to be an hour, you know, in the training prior to soldiers going off where they sit down and talk about how it might feel to kill. An hour when they come back where someone says to them, "Did you kill anyone?" You're saying that that's not part of a formal protocol.
Not a formal protocol, although a lot of the education and training in the military isn't formal protocol. I would say, thanks to the work of Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, who wrote On Killing, people do now talk more about killing.
Well, you know what? I'm going to hold you up there.
About that. But the morality of killing is still something they don't. But it's a challenge. I don't know any government organization or any large company or bureaucracy that teaches morality.
I'm going to hold you up there because we want to talk much more. Some of our listeners have mentioned the book On Killing. We'll ask you more questions about that, Major Kilner, when we come back. And again, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts, letters at here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. An Army major who says that guilt over killing is a major reason soldiers suffer from stress on the battlefield and off. Now, we're not talking today about whether or not soldiers should kill. They do. And Major Kilner believes that philosophical and ethical discussions about killing should be a bigger part of training and post-war care. And Major Kilner, on that note, I just want to ask you, what about the argument that if a soldier is thinking too much, he or she will be killed? That one of the reasons soldiers are somewhat desensitized is for their own safety.
That's a great point, and that's the one probably most brought up by my fellow officers and the guys out in the field. I don't think that I support the way we train, which is very much reflexive training, reflexive firing, responding to stimuli, so that we can shoot faster, more accurately, and kill them so that we don't get killed. But I do think the assurance beforehand that they know that we as a profession take morality seriously, that we're not training them to do anything that they wouldn't do if they thought about it, I think that would help them. And also it'll help them after the battlefield to process it and make sense of it, so that, yes, they did it without thinking, but then they're going to think about it afterwards. And we want them to be at peace. So the next time they go into combat or their next deployment, or even for the rest of their lives, that they understand that what they did reflexively is the same thing they would have done reflectively if they had thought about it. And in fact, the training allowed them to complete their mission and stay alive. So it was a good thing. And they weren't being used.
Right.
They were just being maximized.
Is there a difference in post-traumatic stress when someone has killed and when someone has not killed?
I don't know that. I'm not a psychologist, and I'd love for the psychologist to look into that more. Psychologists have demonstrated, there is good evidence that the biggest single factor for PTSD symptomology is having killed. And it's also closely correlated with having something that you did in war that you won't talk about.
Or won't be talked to about. You do talk to soldiers through your website. It's the Soldier Ethicist, and through your work. What are you hearing?
Well, I think my peer group, the people actually out in the fight, peer group and younger, are very supportive. I've been invited to go actually speak to the senior leaders out at Fort Lewis, Washington in a couple months about this. So people are supportive. There is a lot of killing going on. It's a war. And right now it's hit or miss. Where there are some chaplains who are really strong in this area, and I had one chaplain tell me, you know, I prayed with the guys every time before they went on patrol, and I forgave them their sins when they came back. And they needed that. He said even people who weren't religious outside of war, they had a sense of finality that, wow, I could die here, and I want to make sure that I'm right with God. And so where that happens, I think the soldiers are taken care of. But there's not enough awareness and not enough great chaplains like that.
We have an email from James Nagel, who works with the VA, who says that they are told at the VA that when dealing with vets having behavioral problems, to remember they've been trained to kill. But then he goes on to say they're not these people who work with the vets aren't told about any real ethical issues to talk to the soldiers about. It's more of a accepting of their behavior because that's how they were taught. You've heard from so many soldiers. I'm reading a lot of the anecdotes, and you've heard at least the anecdotal information about soldiers who, I'm reading one now, who's saying on the day that he killed, I think it was in Somalia, I had absolutely no ethical or moral problems with pulling the trigger, but it was later I started thinking that these people had wives, children. Soldiers have written you about having dreams with interacting with the person that they killed, saying to them, why did you kill me?
Yes, I actually got that from Dr. Grossman's book, that latter one. But yes, there's two things that sometimes get conflated. One is combat stress, and that's the soldier who in the middle of a battle or right after battle says, I can't do it anymore. That's one kind of psychological casualty. And the Army has combat stress teams to help them get them back into the fight. Post-traumatic stress disorder isn't that they can't go back into the fight. It's that they have trouble adjusting to life outside of the fight. They have trouble adjusting back into their family and to civil society. And PTSD tends to show up much later after they've had time to reflect on the things they saw and did.
So, Major Pete Kilmer, what are you saying the military should do? Simply, you know, put a leader, and you say that this should be the military leaders, the platoon leaders, put an arm around the shoulder of a soldier and talk about the issue, have a formal classroom experience. What are you saying should happen?
I think there could be some minimal classroom kind of experience, but I think that within the profession of arms, you know, to the outside it just looks like an organization with structure, but to the people within it, it's people who are passionate about doing this well and serving the country. I just think we need, and we talk privately to our best friends about this. We just need to talk more openly to make it a part of the culture in your unit that after people fight, you talk about fear, you talk about the things that we do talk about that are sort of somewhat taboo, but you also help them process, hey, what you did was the right thing and this is why. And you do that before battle, you do that after battle, and you have an awareness so that when soldiers, you know, come back, that they may need forgiveness if they killed wrongly. They may need someone to talk with. So yeah. I don't think the answer is in formal education so much. I think it's more in the informal conversations of the profession.
And you say in the language, in the minute or so we have left, that right now the language is, there is care, and there are people reaching out hands, but they're saying things like, what happened to you, as opposed to what did you do?
Yes, I think the medical profession, as that VA email sort of alluded to, very much looks at the environmental conditions of what happened to you. And so they treat guilt as a symptom to be eliminated with drugs or therapy or whatever else. From the ethical perspective, guilt may be a natural reaction to your perception of doing something wrong. And so you either need to process that through and understand why it wasn't wrong, or even accept that maybe it was and then seek forgiveness or resolution. So PTSD, I think, does have the cause of what happens to you, but what we're overlooking is perhaps it's the things that we did ourselves.
And very brief, Major Kilner, but I just want to point out, you also say that a society that sends people to war needs to be able to talk about killing in war with them when they come back. Major Pete Kilner runs a website called The Soldier Ethicist. It's devoted to finding a moral justification for killing in combat. Major, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you for help there, vets. Then it was time well spent.
Sure it did. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, what does President Bush say? And how does he behave in his private meetings with the families of troops killed in action? We'll have an eye-opening view there. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. For political reporters in New York. Former Massachusetts Governor William Weld, now living in New York, is generating headlines as he enters the governor's race there. And the Republican District Attorney of Westchester County, Janine Pirro, is off to a shaky start, but a columnist's dream, in her attempt to unseat Senator Hillary Clinton. Plus, there are four Democrats vying for the Democratic nomination to run for mayor of New York City, most likely against the incumbent Republican Michael Bloomberg. And to top it off, just this week, the New York Post published transcripts of secretly recorded phone calls made by a top aide to Governor George Pataki, his wife, and then Senator Al D'Amato. Phew. Well, reporter Ben Smith covers politics for the New York Observer. He also writes the paper's political blog. Ben, touch on the news of the week first. Anything in those tapes to report?
Well, I don't think there were any revelations in there, but it was it involved this sort of patronage dispenser of the governor and former Senator D'Amato, talking in, you know, very colorful language and swearing about basically public officials who are refusing to give them enough patronage.
Is it important enough to surface if perhaps Pataki decides to run for president?
I don't think so. I mean, there have been corruption scandals in state government that may haunt him, but I don't think this is one of the bigger ones. It just sort of reinforces that theme.
Well, let's move to Bill Weld. People here in Boston know him well, former governor, the one who dove off a dock to show that the Charles River water was cleaner. He is a New York born and bred fellow, but will he be seen as a carpetbagger by New Yorkers?
I think Hillary Clinton and, you know, Bobby Kennedy before her basically laid the carpetbagger issue to rest. I mean, there's more in terms of it being used as an attack on him.
Is he known in New York?
No, I don't think anyone knows who he is outside political reporters and kind of people who travel in his social circle.
What are they learning about him?
So far, all they've learned is that he has an extremely confusing position on gay marriage.
Remind us.
It seems to be that it's legal in Massachusetts. And he hasn't really spoken clearly on it. This is just bits and pieces of what he said. But his position seems to be that it is right and legal in Massachusetts, but wrong and illegal in New York.
Has he explained that further?
No.
And we understand that gay rights groups have obviously been attacking him on that.
Yeah, and he's been, I mean, a real friend of the gay and lesbian community for his entire career, at least for a long time. And so they're furious at him because they feel really betrayed. So he and Janine Pirro, who's running for Senate, both, they're basically, their first act was to drop long-standing liberal views on social issues.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Jeanine Pirro. She's, of course, running for the Senate seat, trying to upset Hillary Clinton. She's the district attorney of Westchester County at the moment. She ran into some trouble early on.
Yeah, I mean, the deal with her was that she was seen as a star, you know, a charismatic, intelligent, forceful person who had this little liability that her husband had been convicted of tax fraud and that his name kept surfacing in kind of mafia-related cases.
But wait, there's more. When I was in New York last week, all the tabloids were screaming about his child born out of wedlock.
Yeah, you could consider that kind of a subset of the tax fraud, because part of the money he illegally used, the corporate account that he illegally spent, he spent in a failed attempt to fight a paternity suit. So it just kind of gets worse and worse as far as he's concerned. But you know, they knew that coming in. And she was supposed to sort of overwhelm that with the force of her personality and her intelligence. And on her first day, she lost a page from her speech and just sort of stopped dead for 32 seconds, sort of looking for it, which didn't inspire a lot of confidence in her grasp of, you know, what she was doing there.
Unable to ad-lib. Well, by the way, we mentioned what some are framing as the husband problem. And, of course, some people think that's rather ironic, considering that she, Jeanine Pirro, is running against Hillary Clinton. What is the sense of that? You know, will the husband problems, if, you know, you see them that way, cancel each other out?
That's been kind of a running theme in some of the coverage, and it is truly absurd, because Bill Clinton is hugely popular in New York State. They're not running for senator from America. They're running from senator from a fairly liberal state, where Bill Clinton was elected overwhelmingly twice, where George Bush lost twice, and where he's a incredible political asset to Hillary in a way that Al Pirro is just kind of not to Jeanine.
Oh, and by the way, Jeanine Pirro will also have a challenger in the Republican primary. Tell us about that.
She's got a couple, but the best organized and sort of seemingly the strongest is a guy called Ed Cox, who is best known for being Richard Nixon's son-in-law and having married Trisha Nixon on the White House lawn, I think, in 71. And he's a formidable, intelligent guy, a corporate lawyer who spent a lot of his life working with Nixon in these sort of back-channel foreign policy things that Nixon did to rehabilitate his image, you know, meeting with Fidel Castro and things like this. So he's an interesting guy. He doesn't seem likely to quit. He's also more conservative than Pirro and is sort of pushing that.
Well, finally, let's move to the mayor's race in New York City. Four Democrats face off in a primary September 13th. The winner will most likely face the incumbent, Republican Michael Bloomberg, in November. Give us the headline on that race.
I mean, the headline has tended to be, you know, what race? Particularly compared to the real fireworks we're expecting next year, it's been kind of a dud so far. Bloomberg looks very strong. And the Democrats who are running against him are kind of drawn from the second rank of city politics. A couple of people who might have been more formidable decided to sit out the race.
Yeah, but then there was that kerfuffle as to where they were going to send their kids, public or private school.
Yeah, that's always an issue in New York City. And in a debate, the candidates were put on the spot, and one kind of got into a shouting match with the moderator over it, because his kid is 3 and he said he isn't about to commit himself one way or the other. He's also already enrolled that kid in a sort of pre-private kindergarten, because it's very competitive in New York, and you know, this kid is already on track to be in private school. Another, you know, proudly announced that his daughter had graduated from public school when in fact she hadn't. That's always a very charged issue.
The candidate with the 3-year-old is Gifford Miller, who is the city council speaker. Much was made over a moment in that debate where he turned plaintively towards his wife and said, "Pam, Pam, where are we sending the kids to school?" I mean, it just goes to how many real sort of personal, human, colorful moments there have been in politics in New York.
Yeah, it's been a very, I mean, New York politics in New York is always personal, but I mean, I guess the Jeanine Pirro infidelity story is perhaps the most kind of really raw one at the moment. I mean, the New York Post sent a reporter down to where, you know, whatever sort of impoverished southern community his former lover lives in, and got her sort of denouncing him and saying he just bought his daughter a car to buy her silence. I mean, it was quite ugly, and nothing is, I mean, I guess you guys know this in Boston too with the Herald, but there's definitely nothing kind of off limits to the tabloids.
And it's only August.
And it's only August of 2005.
Ben Smith, political reporter for the New York Observer. He also writes the paper's political blog, The Politicker. Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And other news from the world of politics. Two influential Washington lobby groups are taking sides today in the nomination of Judge John Roberts to the Supreme Court. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has come out in favor of President Bush's nominee. The Business Federation is praising Roberts for attracting bipartisan support, and it said that Roberts had a keen intellect and was open-minded. But the People for the American Way opposes the nomination. The liberal group criticized Roberts for his service in the administrations of Presidents Reagan and the first President Bush. Ralph Nies of the organization said, "The fundamental rights and liberties of Americans are too precious to entrust to someone who spent more than a decade trying to narrow them." Senate hearings on the Roberts nomination begin next month. Still to come, star of Grand Hotel, Camille Matahari. We look back at the short life of Greta Garbo in film. You're listening to Here Now. Over 500,000 children are in foster care, and thousands are separated from their brothers and sisters, living in different homes, often miles apart. But a summer camp program called Camp to Belong reunites these kids every year. Recently, Here Now's Monica Brady Meyerhoff visited one of these camps on Cape Cod.
Campers look wary as they get off the bus clutching a favorite pillow or backpack, and counselors cheer their arrival. Unlike many camps that reunite summer friends, this camp is reuniting sisters and brothers who live apart. Derek, a 13-year-old dressed in jean shorts to his ankles, a do-rag, hat, and heavy gold watch, stands quietly to the side. Big Daddy, one of the counselors, asks him who he's waiting for.
Where are they coming from?
12 of them are coming from Brockton, I think.
Soon, Derek's sister and his two brothers arrive. There isn't a lot to say, at least not right away. They haven't seen each other in months. Three are with foster parents, and one is in a group home. This will be the first time in years that they will all be together for an entire week.
You had a kid, did you?
After some tentative looks, they start teasing each other about their hair.
I got my hair done yesterday because...
This is exactly the kind of interaction camp founder Lynn Price hopes for.
It's not like we're finding brothers and sisters. We know where each other live, in the same communities, going to the same schools. But now Camp to Belong gives them the opportunity to fight over who's going to sit where in the dining hall, or share a birthday party, or say their nighttime prayers together. Typical childhood memories.
Camp to Belong is 10 years old and operates yearly camps in Colorado, California, Maine, and now Massachusetts. This year at Camp Wingate Kirkland in Yarmouth.
Okay, with an accident. Okay.
It's clear Alicia and Sarah are already close by the way 14-year-old Sarah clings to her 16-year-old sister's arm. They live an hour apart in Western Mass, but they went to Camp to Belong in Colorado last year.
But it did bring us closer together. It made us think of a lot of things that we never thought about before, like who was our uncle, or like...
We actually kind of know what each other's favorite color is now, and kind of what we like and don't like, and we're still learning that today. So.
Their caseworker from the Massachusetts Department of Social Services, Noni Boothalette, is here too as a volunteer counselor.
It's really tough because we don't have enough foster homes, and that's why a lot of kids get separated when they come into care. And it really depends on the foster family. Some foster parents are great at getting kids together. It is hard. Social workers are overwhelmed.
Boothalette is a part-time social worker, but she's responsible for 17 cases, which is considered a full-time load. The camp is run like most summer camps. Silly songs, family dining, sleeping in bunk beds. There are 53 children in foster care here and 60 volunteer camp counselors. One counselor, IKEA Kid, is a 20-year-old still in foster care in Chicago.
I don't know if you have a brother or a sister. Could you fathom only seeing them one day out of the year? Camp gave me a chance to spend a week with my sisters and brothers.
19-year-old Christina and her 14-year-old brother Anthony were put in separate foster care homes 6 years ago.
I always was there for him, sort of taking care of him and my mom at the same time. So it was tough, and we got split apart, and I didn't have that, like, older sister, motherly type thing. Like, we talked on the phone sometimes, but we didn't see each other.
After the sun goes down, the kids and counselors gather around a campfire. Founder Lynn Price tells her own story. When she was 8, she learned she wasn't living with her biological family.
Today, and the truth is, we're not your parents. We're your foster parents.
And Price discovered she had a sister she never knew. It took them years to feel close. She started the camp to bring together foster siblings. Although they are separated now, these kids will eventually leave the foster care system, and Price wants them to leave with childhood memories of time together.
Here now is Monica Brady-Meyerhoff in Yarmouth, Massachusetts. For more information on Camp to Belong, check out our website at here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. The 100th anniversary of the birth of cinematic icon Greta Garbo. After the Swedish actress was brought to Hollywood in the 1920s, she wove her spell in silent films such as Flesh and the Devil, and later in the talkies, Camille and Mata Hari. Her fans were shocked when she suddenly retired from filmmaking in 1941 at the age of 36 to lead a life determinedly out of the public eye until her death in 1990. Her need for privacy caused many to equate Garbo with one of her most famous roles. Remember, she was only 27 when she played an aging ballerina in 1932's Grand Hotel and uttered what would become her signature line.
I want to be alone.
Where have you been? I suppose I can cancel the Vienna contract?
I just want to be alone.
Greta Garbo is also the subject of author and film historian Mark Vieira's new book, Greta Garbo, A Cinematic Legacy, and he spoke with Here and Now's arts critic, Bill Marks.
First, I'd just like to ask you a little bit about the I want to be alone aspect of Garbo. Was she really that shy, or was this simply a marketing strategy to make her seem more mysterious to the public?
I would say it was 20% marketing, 80% almost agoraphobia. She really had a fear of strangers and a fear of unfamiliar places. She did travel quite a bit, but there was always the places that she knew and knew well.
Garbo has been the subject of many biographies, all trying to, you know, plumb her secrets. But few books like yours have really looked at her movies, certainly in such a systematic way. I mean, why do you think that that there are so few books on her movies? You see what I mean.
Would say that it was a kind of intellectual snobbery that took place in the 50s and was perpetuated after that by later writers. It was, oh, those films are dumb Hollywood movies meant to fulfill a matinee audience's cravings for fantasy, and they don't deserve any serious consideration. Well, I think that they're exquisitely crafted vehicles. Escapist, yes, which is what people wanted, but you can look at them at many levels and find them very satisfying, especially visually. They have so many moments where they create images of her that you just can't get out of your head.
Let's hear a clip from 1930s Anna Christie.
Give me a whiskey, ginger ale on the side. And don't be stingy, baby.
Now, Anna Christie was Garbo's first talking film. What were the strengths and the weaknesses of Garbo when she opened her mouth?
She said herself that she enjoyed making a film most when she didn't have to bother about particulars in the dialogue. She liked to say the words, give them feeling, but she liked it if it was kind of a fantasy to her. But obviously she could not do that in this case. It was a Eugene O'Neill play. But I'd say she more than dispelled the myth that she didn't really care about what she was doing or liked it best when it was a fantasy. She really was, in every sense of the word, a trained professional actor.
Now, you mention in the book, you quote actor Melvin Douglas, who acted with Garbo a few times. He says, I've never played with a woman with such an ability to arouse the erotic impulse. We are so much more in films today, so much more sexually explicit. So, I mean, why should we care about Garbo today, given the fact that her voltage in the 20s and the 30s really isn't quite as high or as electrifying as perhaps some of the sexuality we have on screen today?
Well, I would say that it is. It's just that she didn't, and she wasn't allowed to, remove her garments, except in Mata Hari, which was later censored during a reissue. But these films are very sexual, and that was totally unheard of at that time, just completely revolutionary. And that's why when you see a Garbo film, there's that element, but there's also the element of a kind of spirituality that she has that is blended with the sensuality. And that's, to my mind, what makes her unique as a performer and as a film icon. It's just this wonderful other level. Like she transcends these, you know, in many cases, pedestrian stories with, of course, the help of a brilliant cameraman and some very clever directors. But she gives something to these roles that's not found in other performers. And if there's a mystery about Garbo, it's why, in an era before X-rated movies, how and why she was able to project this amazing quality.
Well, one thing you do mention in the book somewhat is also the factor of androgyny in her image. You know, the fact is that she, you know, she welcomed dressing in man's garb in her film Queen Christina. And, of course, all the rumors of her bisexuality, you know, having both affairs with men and women throughout her life.
What I did discover was that she had affairs with George Brent, her co-star in The Painted Veil, with Ruben Mamoulian, her director of Queen Christina. I could not find any real evidence that she'd had more than an association as a friend with Mercedes da Costa. And, of course, Sulke of Your Tale has always been branded as bisexual. I found no evidence of that either. But there still is that aspect of androgyny that's very visible in so many of her films. Her very carriage is neither male nor female. Her deep voice, her features, which are, you know, very plastic and sculptured. I just think that that's what grabbed people initially, was this, you know, 20-year-old girl looking like nobody else in Hollywood and acting like nobody else in these very steamy stories about vamps. It electrified people. They just didn't know how to respond, except by, you know, paying more nickels and dimes to go see the films again and again and again.
Also, I think one thing, an argument that your book makes, which is also an interesting one, is that Garbo wouldn't have been Garbo without the talents of various photographers, cinematographers, and so forth, who, in a sense, helped create Garbo and her look and that, you know, the sexuality by the way they photographed her.
I don't think Garbo at Warner Brothers or Columbia or RKO would have been the same Garbo we see in the MGM movies, because MGM was a factory where they manufactured glamorous stars, and she needed to do the grooming very badly when she arrived. She was just this frizzy-haired teenager with funny front teeth, and well, they went to work on her immediately.
Now, the photos in the book are terrific. I mean, they're wonderful, and the reproductions are also first rate. So you get an idea of Garbo's allure just from seeing these photographs. What are some of your favorite pictures of Garbo in the book? And why are they your favorites? I mean, there are just so many of them that it would be hard to choose, frankly.
I would say two of my favorites are towards the end of the book. One is the last photo in the Ninotchka chapter, and this is a portrait of her that I saw in Look magazine when I was about 11 years old, and I said I have to have that picture for this book because it expresses so much about her. It's a photo that could have been taken, you know, in the 18th century, the 20th century, or now. It's just she looks like a goddess. It's a transcendent, magical, glowing image of a human being taken to the nth degree of photographic perfection. And then the other picture that I really searched high and low for was the picture of her looking into her magnifying mirror, which is in the Two-Faced Woman chapter. And in that picture, which was a candid taken with a long lens on the set. Now, she knew she was being photographed, but she didn't know the exact moment that any of these photos were being taken. But in this case, this man caught her looking into the magnifying mirror, and you see in her face such anxiety and yet a steeliness of, I'm not happy with what I see, but I'm going to continue. And seeing a couple of photos like that, I could believe that she did retire because she looked at the rushes on her films, or didn't, and was not happy with what she saw.
Mark Vieira, author of Greta Garbo, A Cinematic Legacy, thanks for talking to me.
Thank you, Bill.
And this note, to see the pictures that Mark and Bill Marks were talking about, as well as other photos of Garbo, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now,
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com, and by REMAX of New England, a source for real estate assistance in New England, featuring an online renovation guide, agent locator, and comprehensive property search. REMAX-NewEngland.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories.